Well, it's time for us here at IRIS to wish our listeners who have a birthday today on December 29th a very happy birthday. We have three listeners: Kenneth Armstrong of Storm Lake, Lila Nyhaus of Mason City, and Judy Prettyman of Des Moines. All of us here at IRIS would like to wish you three a very happy birthday. And if today is your birthday and you did not hear your name, please give us a call to make sure we can get you on our birthday list. You can call us at 515-243-6833 or toll free from anywhere in Iowa at 1-877-404-4747. We're so glad to have you with us. If you're listening on your television, internet, or mobile device, and you're not a registered IRIS listener, please give us a call. We need to know who is listening and how you are listening in order to keep our services free. You can catch a replay of today's readings at 6 p.m. and 1 a.m. here on IRIS. Today's show, as well as many of our other newspapers and programs, are available as podcasts on our website at iowaradioreading.org. And now here's Barb to continue with today's Des Moines Register.
Thank you, Dennis. New York City turns to tests to keep schools open. New York City will increase COVID-19 testing in schools when the holiday break ends next week in an effort to keep classrooms open despite a surge in infections due to the highly infectious Omicron variant of the virus, Mayor Bill de Blasio announced Tuesday. New York State will provide the city's public schools with 2 million test kits so the tests can be sent home with students if a classmate tests positive, de Blasio said, and students who test negative won't have to quarantine. This is how we are going to look at schools from this point on. Keep them safe and keep them open, de Blasio said. Wide distribution of at-home test kits to every classroom. And when there's a positive case in a classroom, every child takes home at-home test kits. Every child who tests negative comes back to school. It's as simple as that. So long as they're asymptomatic and so long as they test negative, they keep coming to school. Mayor-elect Eric Adams, who will take over from his fellow Democrat on January 1st, said he supports the plan. Two clear messages we're sending loud and clear, Adams said. Your children are safer in school, the numbers speak for themselves, and we're united to make sure they continue to be safe. New York City's public school system was one of the first in the nation to reopen to in-person learning after the pandemic hit in 2020. But frequent school or classroom closings due to COVID-19 cases proved disruptive. The new approach will guarantee more consistency, de Blasio said. Dennis?
Thank you. Colorado gunman kills five in attack. A gunman who went on a shooting rampage through several business districts in and around Denver was targeting at least some of his victims, authorities said Tuesday. The suspect in the Monday night shootings killed five people, including one who succumbed to her injuries, Tuesday, police said. The gunman also died Monday after exchanging gunfire with officers in a shopping area in the Denver suburb of Lakewood, police said. Matt Clark, commander of the Denver Police Department's Major Crimes Division, said during a Tuesday news conference that the suspect, Lyndon James McLeod, 47, was on the radar of law enforcement and that he knew some of his victims. Denver Police Chief Paul Pazin did not say what authorities had investigated McLeod for in the past, but noted no charges were filed. The shooting started shortly after 5 p.m. in central Denver along Broadway, a busy street lined with shops, bars, and restaurants, where two women were killed and a man was injured, Pazin said. On Tuesday, candles and flower bouquets rested at the scene. The suspect also shot and wounded a Lakewood police officer after leaving the hotel, Romero said. Police and the suspect then exchanged gunfire and the suspect died. It was not immediately clear if police officer had shot him. The wounded officer underwent surgery Monday night, and his condition was not immediately known. Barb?
Thank you, Dennis. Now in the Nation and World Watch, North Dakota man convicted of killing four gets life in prison. Chad Isaac, 47, who was convicted of killing four people in what authorities say was one of the most gruesome crimes in North Dakota history, was sentenced Tuesday to four consecutive life prison terms without the possibility of parole. The four were shot and stabbed April 1, 2019, inside the property management company's building in Mandan, a city of about 20,000 people. Investigators said the victims were stabbed more than 100 times total. North Dakota doesn't have the death penalty. U.S. warships stay in Mediterranean amid Ukraine and Russian fear. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin ordered U.S. Navy aircraft carrier strike group to stay in the Mediterranean Sea region rather than move on to the Middle East, amid worries about the buildup of Russian troops near the Ukraine border. A defense official, who spoke on condition of anonymity, said Tuesday that the change in the schedule of the USS Harry S. Truman and the five American warships accompanying it reflects the need for a presence in Europe. The Truman entered the Mediterranean Sea on December 14th. Sudan officials say defunct mine collapses and kills 38 people. Sudanese authorities said at least 38 people were killed Tuesday when a defunct gold mine collapsed in the West Kordofan province. The country's state-owned mining company said in a statement the collapse of the closed, non-functioning mine took place in the village of Fuja, 435 miles south of the capital of Khartoum. It said there were injuries without giving a specific tally. Local media reported that several shafts collapsed at the Darsaya mine, and that besides dead, at least 8 injured people were taken to a local hospital. And Kuwait names new cabinet amid political and financial troubles. Kuwait's ruling emir announced the formation of a new cabinet on Tuesday, breaking a month-long deadlock with the nomination of 15 new government ministers. The new cabinet of Prime Minister Sheikh Sadah al-Khalid al-Hamad al-Sah represents the Gulf Arab states' fourth government over the last year and a half. Kuwait has struggled to defuse a standoff between members of the Gulf's only elected parliament and an emir-appointed government. Back to you, Dennis.
Thank you, Barb. I'm going to take something from USA Today in relation to the article I just read on the Colorado shootings. Denver area mourns 5 deaths in shooting spree. Alfredo Cardenas went to his daughter's tattoo shop Tuesday morning and lit a candle to remember her life. Alicia Cardenas, 44, was among the 5 people killed Monday night after a person opened fire in several locations in the Denver area. "It's a shock," Cardenas told USA Today outside the Soul Tribe tattoo shop on Broadway. Cardenas, Danny Schofield, 38, and Sarah Steck, 28, were among the 5 people killed by the shooter. Police did not release the identities of the other 2 fatal victims. The shooter, Lyndon James McLeod, 47, was also killed in a gunfight with police. 2 others, including a police officer whose identity has not yet been released, were injured in the shootings, Denver and Lakewood police said at a joint press conference Tuesday. The very violent series of events across multiple locations began in Denver on Monday evening and ended in nearby Lakewood, Denver Police Chief Paul Pazin at a press conference said late Monday. The victims at or near the tattoo shops were previously known to the shooter, police said Tuesday. McLeod also had previous interactions with the Hyatt Hotel where he shot and killed Steck, who was a clerk there. Surveillance video provided by a nearby business owner to USA Today and taken Monday night shows a dark-colored van pulling up outside Lucky 13 in Lakewood, 1 of 5 known shooting locations. A man who appeared to be carrying a firearm steps out of the van, leaving the door open and the engine apparently running, and walks calmly into the tattoo shop. He walks out 10 seconds later, climbs into the van, and drives away. By Tuesday morning, there were few signs of the previous evening's violence. A bullet hole in the window casing of an Xfinity store and boarded up windows at a nearby restaurant in Lakewood. A few businesses posted signs saying they were temporarily closed, and a stream of people crunched on an occasional piece of broken glass as they entered a yoga studio for a morning class. At the tattoo shop in Denver, people began gathering Tuesday to mourn and leave flowers at a memorial. Alfredo Cardenas said his 12-year-old granddaughter was with her father and doesn't yet understand what happened. "She's going to need a lot of love and compassion," he said. At least 2 of the other shootings took place at or near tattoo shops, according to the addresses provided by police, including Lucky 13 in Lakewood. Colorado Governor Jared Polis said in a statement that he was deeply disturbed by the violence. "Tragedies like this, especially in the midst of the holidays, are deeply unsettling," Polis said. My administration is working with local law enforcement to understand what happened last evening and provide the needed support throughout the investigation. 6 people died, including the shooter, authorities said. 2 people were injured, including a police officer. Alicia Cardenas, one of the victims, was a tattooer, mural artist, and cultural anthropologist, according to the Soul Tribe website. The website describes the shop owner as a, quote, true Denver native and a proud indigenous artist. Dozens of people posted online tributes for Cardenas and describing her as a force of nature and a beloved pioneer in the world of tattooing. She accepted everybody, especially those on the fringes, her dad told USA Today. Denver resident Patrick Anderson, age 50, described Cardenas as a wise friend who hosted a Dia de los Muertos ceremony every year. She is one of the wisest and most caring individuals I have ever met, Anderson told USA Today. Schofield, another victim, was a tattoo artist and a Colorado native, according to the Lucky 13 Tattoo and Piercing website. He had been tattooing for about 15 years, according to the site. He was also known as Dano Blair. Authorities have not announced McLeod's motives, but said he had some connection to all of his victims. Pazin also said McLeod was previously on police's radar with 2 investigations into incidences from mid-2020 and early 2021. Pazin said neither investigation resulted in criminal charges and would not give further details about those incidents. This is not an unknown party to us, Pazin said. A tattoo industry connection to McLeod's shooting rampage seems likely, with the owner of Tattoo Studio operating from the site of a one-time McLeod business saying he purchased the place from Alicia Cardenas. This is the 13th mass shooting in Colorado this year, according to the Gun Violence Archive, a nonprofit that tracks gun violence nationally using a combination of police statistics and media reports. Back to you, Bart.
Thank you, Dennis. Mother of teen prayed as daughter died. Parents share details about LAPD shooting. Soledad Peralta and her daughter were trying on dresses for Christmas in a Burlington store Thursday when they heard screams. Her daughter, Valentina Oriana Peralta, 14, locked the doors to the dressing room. They hit the floor, hugged one another tightly, closed their eyes, and prayed. Moments later, 3 pops sounded, and Valentina started convulsing. I tried to wake her up by shaking her, but she didn't wake up, Peralta said in a statement read by one of her attorneys, as others behind her held up large photos of the teen. A Los Angeles police officer had fired on a man seen on video beating a woman with a metal bike lock. One of the bullets pierced a wall behind the suspect and hit the teen, who had been in the USA for only 6 months and dreamed of becoming an American citizen and engineer. She died in her mother's arms. Peralta said she screamed, but help didn't immediately arrive. Police eventually pulled her from the dressing room, she said. Her daughter's body remained on the ground. She and Valentina's father, Juan Pablo Orellana Lorenes, who traveled from their native Chile, shared more about their daughter and the day she was killed during a news conference Tuesday with their attorneys, who vowed justice for the teen. Peralta sobbed, wearing a sign in Spanish, which translates to in English to Justice for Our Daughter, Valentina. Her father wore a similar sign in English. Nearby, a large photo of their daughter set on an easel, surrounded by white roses. Quote, to see a son or daughter die in your arms is one of the greatest pains and most profound pains that any human being can imagine, Peralta said through a translator at the news conference. Valentina meant the world to us, to her family, to her friends, and to her schoolmates. And now our sweet angel has left forever, end quote. The shooting sparked criticism of the LAPD and questions about the tactics police use when an officer fired with a long rifle in a crowded department store 2 days before Christmas. Valentina and the suspect, Daniel Elena Lopez, 24, died in the shooting. The LAPD released an edited video package online Monday that included 911 calls, police radio transmission, body camera footage, and surveillance video from the shooting. The footage showed the suspect's erratic movements in the store, his attacks on multiple customers, and the moment the officer fired. In the footage, police didn't give any commands to the suspect, who was shot down the aisle from a bloodied assault victim. He held the metal bike lock and a piece of artwork when he was shot. The lone officer who fired was told to slow down by more than a dozen times by other responding officers before shots were fired, police footage shows. He was placed on administrative leave, the department confirmed to USA Today, and was not publicly identified. The officers were armed with a variety of weapons, including non-lethal firearms, and made their way toward the suspect in the midst of his attack on a woman who was shopping in the store. The officer who fired offered to lead the group of officers. How officers respond to such incidents has evolved over the years. A 911 call released by police showed officers were told the suspect had been shooting inside the crowded store, information that was later deemed incorrect. Since the shooting in 1999 at Columbine High School in Colorado, police departments have changed procedures and protocols on responding to active shooters. Instead of securing an area and waiting for backup, law enforcement officers have been trained to engage immediately on the scene. An active shooter presentation by the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, which has jurisdiction for a large area surrounding the city of L.A., notes the primary goal when law enforcement contacts a suspect is to, quote, stop suspect's deadly behavior and take the suspect into custody with the least amount of force necessary. Officers should give clear and concise orders to the suspect, end quote. Attorneys for Valentina's family said police could have done plenty differently to prevent her death. Quote, never should this 14-year-old girl have ended up as collateral damage, civil rights attorney Ben Crump said Tuesday. We should not have to sacrifice innocent life in the name of safety when it was foreseeable that 2 days before Christmas there were going to be people in a shopping plaza shopping. The teen's father had planned the trip from Chile to see her for Christmas. They were going to attend a Lakers game and see LeBron James play. They chatted on the phone the day before her death about how she'd passed her math and physics exam at High Tech Los Angeles Charter High School. He said she loved skateboarding and had a new skateboard she wanted to show friends at school. Her favorite color was pink. It is like my whole heart has been ripped out of my body, Lorenz said in a statement read by attorneys. My daughter was special. She had dreams. And tragically, those dreams have been overshadowed by this nightmare that prevents me from sleeping at night. He said Christmas gifts ordered online for her were delivered to their home after her death. The pain of seeing those gifts, he said, cannot be articulated. The gifts, he said through tears, will be placed on her grave. Back to you, Dennis.
Thank you. South is bracing for possible tornado threat. In the West, officials prepare for extreme cold. A little weather news. While much of the nation deals with heavy snow and intense cold, severe weather was in the forecast Wednesday across portions of the Deep South. Large hail, damaging winds, and a few tornadoes are all possible, meteorologists warned. States where the severe weather is most likely include Mississippi, Alabama, and Tennessee. Cities in the path of the storms include Memphis, Nashville, Birmingham, and Atlanta, AccuWeather said. The threat will be mainly in the late afternoon into the evening hours, weather.com meteorologist Ari Sarsalari said. This latest severe weather threat comes just more than 2 weeks after a devastating tornado outbreak left entire towns in ruins and at least 92 people dead, most of them in Kentucky. Though Wednesday's storms are expected to remain south of the hardest hit areas, any rain or wind will be enough to hinder cleanup efforts for a time, AccuWeather said. Before the severe storms arrive, unseasonably warm air will continue to pour into the southern plains and southeast, and more record-high temperatures were expected on both Tuesday and Wednesday. Elsewhere, frigid temperatures continue in the Pacific Northwest and in northern plains, and heavy snow fell across the western mountains. Calling the cold, quote, dangerous and life-threatening, the National Weather Service said temperatures will fall below minus 20 degrees in parts of Montana and North Dakota, which combined with gusty winds will cause wind chills to plummet as low as 50 degrees below zero in some areas. Frostbite will occur within minutes on exposed skin, the Weather Service said. Across normally mild western Washington and Oregon, officials and private groups opened emergency spaces for people to find refuge. forecaster said the extreme cold from the Arctic blast could last until next weekend. In Seattle, Katie West walked a short distance in the snow from the tent where she usually stays to find refuge at a small warming center at an American Legion hall. "I'm not even willing to stay in it right now. It's just so difficult," she said of her tent on Monday. Farther south, more than 9 feet of snow has already fallen in parts of the Sierra Nevada, and still more snow and rain are ahead for California this week, weather.com said. The snow closed key highways, and forecasters warned that travel in the Sierras could be difficult for several days. Meanwhile, in the Midwest, Chicago picked up its first measurable snow of the winter season on Tuesday. 1 to 3 inches was forecast in parts of the metro area. Barb?
Thank you, Dennis. This is from the USA Today Money section. Don't be grounded by health issues. Follow tips to travel safely with a chronic condition. The last 20 months have changed almost all aspects of daily life. And if you have a chronic health condition and have travel planned, there are added precautions you should implement to protect yourself even more. We asked health experts for advice about how those who live with chronic health conditions can plan ahead and stay safer. So if you're visiting relatives or friends for the holidays, or just have a long-awaited trip planned, here's how you safely can enjoy a reunion with loved ones and your pent-up wanderlust. In general, medical professionals say those with chronic illness can travel safely by taking extra precautions. However, in the area of COVID-19, more of a risk-benefit analysis should be considered to determine if the travel makes sense with your condition. You want to keep your health needs at the top of your to-do list. What precautions should someone with a chronic illness take while traveling? First, make sure you are vaccinated and have gotten your booster, says Elena Brinley Rajakopal, a Southern California-based emergency medicine physician. The next step is to evaluate the location to which you are traveling. Rajakopal suggests asking these questions. Are infections rising there? Are there precautions in place for everyone, for vaccinated travelers and for unvaccinated travelers? She stresses the importance of understanding testing, masking, and social distancing regulations at your destination. Always wear a mask, preferably KN95 or N95, she says, especially on airplanes and when in close proximity to other people. Mask fit is very important for effectiveness, so be sure it fits firmly against your face and stays over your mouth and nose at all times, Rajakopal says. Stay at least 6 feet away from other people and avoid large group gatherings whenever possible. If you are gathering with family and friends for the holidays, an outdoor setting is preferable. If your doctor is supportive of your plans, Rajakopal says, it's vital to have a discussion about what to do if your conditions worsen. You should also know where the local medical facilities are and how to access them. Finally, make sure you have enough of your medications to last the trip, plus a bit extra in case there are delays or you have to be quarantined, she said. Bring enough medication for your trip, but also pack extra medication. Before the pandemic, I recommended 1 week of extra medication. But in the era of COVID-19, I usually recommend 2 to 3 weeks of extra medication, just in case of a quarantine situation, she advises. Whether you are traveling or not, you should have a list of your medications and dosages, in case you lose them or must go to a hospital outside of your network, she says. To provide an added layer of protection, you also may want to consider wearing a bracelet or necklace listing your medical conditions. In addition, always keep your medical supplies close. You should always pack your medications in your carry-on, never in your checked luggage, Rajakopal cautions. If you have dietary restrictions, travel can present risks. Try to pack some snacks that you can eat in case your meal requirements aren't available while you're in transit, she recommends. Getting there needs planning as well. Since travel is mandated mask requirements, planes are relatively safe, Rajakopal says. However, it can be difficult to predict who your seatmates are and how compliant they will be. Try to travel with family or close friends so that you can occupy an entire row on the aircraft and distance yourself from others, she says. Ideally, your destination should have masking, social distancing, and entry testing requirements to maximize safety, she adds. Once you have determined that your destination is safe enough for you to travel, you should visit your doctor and discuss your individual condition and any extra precautions you may need to take. Be aware of your surroundings. While current regulations ask people not to travel if they are sick, it is possible someone will still fly while ill, she says. If you are seated next to someone who is coughing or appears unwell, you may want to explain your condition to a flight attendant and ask to move next to someone who is not coughing. How to plan for international travel. So whether traveling in the U.S. or internationally, check in with your healthcare professional well in advance. Depending on your specific condition, the advice may be different, says Jan Carney, Associate Dean for Public Health and Health Policy, Professor of Medicine and Director of the Graduate Public Health Programs at Larner College of Medicine at the University of Vermont. International travel may require additional preparation. Before you go, check on your specific health insurance coverage. Will you be covered in a different U.S. state if you need medical care? What about international travel? Carney stresses you should know how and where to get health care if you need it. Check in advance about local hospitals and clinics in the area where you will be staying. If you need a specialist, ask your health care professional for a recommendation before you leave, says Carney. Also, if you are visiting a foreign country, Rajakabal advises making sure you know how to translate the words help, hospital, and emergency, plus the names for your particular medical conditions in that language. She also suggests you have your medical conditions written down in the language of the country to which you're traveling, so you can show the doctor if needed. And try and stick to your normal routines. Whether it's taking your prescription medicine at proper times, sticking to a healthy diet, staying hydrated and exercising, don't underestimate the importance of your health habits. Keep your best health routine for sleeping, eating, and taking any medications you need, Carney says. This is especially important for longer trips. Remember to drink plenty of water, wear comfortable clothes, and stretch or walk around on long flights. Back to you, Dennis.
Thank you. 5G's rollout could lead to more flight delays. If certain not yet activated 5G phone frequencies don't stay in airplane mode, the Federal Aviation Administration is prepared to hang up on some flights in January. The regulatory agency announced on December 7th that possible interference with aircraft radio altimeters from upcoming C-band cell site transmitters would require it to prohibit pilots from relying on those instruments to track their altitude near particular airports. Or in a plainer language than that of this FAA airworthiness directive, if bad weather means pilots can't see a runway near those cell sites after AT&T and Verizon light up C-band frequencies on January 5th, expect them to land elsewhere or not take off at all. You'll be forced to divert the flight to an airport that is not 5G covered, said Robert Mann, president of the aviation industry consulting firm RW Mann and Company. Or you'll have to not dispatch the plane. But while we won't know which flights might get an FAA veto until the agency issues NOTAMs or Notice to Air Missions, naming airports the weather allows forecast, John Cox, a retired U.S. Airway pilot who writes USA Today's Ask the Captain column, said the Washington, D.C. to Boston megatropolis and the Pacific Northwest were at risk of cascading interruptions. The whole northeast quarter can be down when you have the right fog conditions, he said. The other one that concerns me is the northwest Seattle, Portland, those areas where the fog is a matter of routine. The actual risk of interference remains unclear, as the FAA directive notes that these gigahertz frequencies, for which AT&T and Verizon paid $23 billion and $45 billion earlier this year, don't overlap radio altimeters. Some models of altimeters might get confused anyway by adjacent signals, but we don't know which ones. The FAA directive does invite airlines to certify that they've tested their equipment against C-band interference, although Mann noted that replacing susceptible altimeters would demand extra testing and certification. It's more than just plugging in a new radial altimeter. Feld, however, said airlines' self-certification represents the most likely solution because airlines will take the heat for flight interruptions. If people's flights are delayed, they're not going to blame Verizon and AT&T, he said. They're going to blame Southwest Airlines and Delta. And that brings us to the halfway point of today's Des Moines Register here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. All programs heard on IRIS are intended for the use of Iowans who have a print disability. If you're not if you're not a registered IRIS listener, or would like more information about our service, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 or toll free at 1-877-404-4747. We need to know who is listening to keep our services free. For the past 90 minutes, your readers have been Barb DeHeck and Dennis May. We're glad to have you listening. And now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
We're back from our short break. I'm Pam Rhodes, and my partner at the other microphone for the next 90 minutes is Peggy Ertz. We will be reading the opinions, obituaries, sports, and other news from today's Des Moines Register and USA Today. We will wrap up with Dear Abby and a weather recap. In Minnesota, jury brings justice, not so in Iowa. This article is written by Randy Evans, a retired journalist. You can contact him at dmrevins2810@gmail.com. Minnesota and its government officials delivered an important lesson recently on how to provide justice, and their lesson should be taken to heart by their neighbors in Iowa. The contrast is jarring between the way government handled the deaths of Dante Wright in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, and Autumn Steele in Burlington, Iowa. One was shot to death trying to evade arrest. The other was an unintended victim of a fatal shooting. Iowans should be uncomfortable with the questions that grow naturally out of these contrasts. We should be embarrassed by the starkly different ways government in the two states treated the people responsible for these deaths, Police Officer Kimberly Potter and Police Officer Jesse Hill. Dante Wright, 20, was driving in the Minneapolis suburb on April 11, 2021, when an officer stopped him because an air freshener was hanging from his rear view mirror and because the license plates on his car were expired. A computer check then found there was a warrant for Wright's arrest for failing to appear in court on a gun possession charge. When the officer tried to put handcuffs on him and take him into custody, Wright pulled loose and tried to drive away. A second officer, Kimberly Potter, warned Wright she had a taser, but she mistakenly fired her semi-automatic handgun, not her electronic stun gun, and Wright died from his wound. In the Iowa case, Autumn Steele, 34, was arguing with her husband Gabriel outside their home on January 6, 2015, as Gabriel Steele held the couple's toddler. Officer Jesse Hill was dispatched to sort out the dispute. Moments after arriving, the Steele's dog came running toward the group. Hill had a fear of dogs. He pulled a semi-automatic handgun and started backing away. He slipped on the snowy ground as he fired two bullets, fatally wounding Autumn Steele. 1 month after the Burlington shooting, before the complete police body camera video was made public, and before summaries of witness statements were released, Des Moines County Attorney Amy Beavers decided Hill would face no criminal charges. She said he acted appropriately to protect himself from the threat the dog posed, even though the Steels and their 3-year-old son were just feet away when Hill fired his gun. Hill was never disciplined for his actions. It is worth noting that Beaver's report did not include statements from witnesses who contradicted the officer's account that the dog was being aggressive. The report also excluded another piece of evidence, that Hill's dog bite injury did not require even a Band-Aid. In contrast with the limited information made public in the days after the Burlington shooting, Minnesota officials released police body camera video. Potter resigned within a couple of days of the tragedy, sparing city officials from the public pressure to fire her. Potter was charged with manslaughter by the state attorney general. His involvement avoided potential conflict of interests by removing the decision from the local prosecutor, who works closely with the Brooklyn Center Police. In contrast, Beavers herself made the decision in the Burlington case, even though she worked daily with the police. On December 23, a jury found Potter guilty of manslaughter. Under Minnesota sentencing guidelines, she faces a potential prison term of 6 to 8 years. Prosecutor Aaron Eldridge told jurors, accidents can still be crimes. This was a colossal screw-up of epic proportions. But no Iowa jury ever got a chance to weigh whether Autumn Steele's death was simply a horrible, unavoidable accident, or whether it resulted from Officer Hill's reckless or negligent use of a gun so close to innocent bystanders. Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison said law officers should not be discouraged by Potter held accountable for her actions, something he said provided the Wright family with a measure of accountability. I wish nothing but the best for her and her family, he said of Potter, but the truth is she will be able to correspond with them and visit with them no matter what happens. The Wright family won't be able to talk with Dante. Likewise, Autumn Steele's children, her husband, and her dear mother, Gina, have not been able to talk with her for the past 7 years. Unlike Minnesota, the justice system in Iowa did not provide even a measure of accountability.
And now going to the letters to the editor for today. We have three of them. First one is from Roger Hanelman of Urbandale. Holiday lights are a waste. Can an estimate be determined as to the amount of dollars spent during the Christmas season for the purchase of outdoor lighting? Sorry, I'm trying to make sure I've got the controls completely off. There we go. Can an estimate be determined as to the amount of dollars spent during the Christmas season for the purchase of outdoor lighting? It is not just the original cost of the lights, but having the lights installed, removed, and the amount of electricity consumed. I do believe that money could be donated to people in need. Again, from Roger Hamelman of Urbandale. We need more independent thinking like mansions. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki seems to have a very basic misunderstanding of the roles of the three branches of the government. She states that Senator Joe Manchin's decision to walk away from this draft of the Build Back Better bill is a, quote, breach of his commitments, end quote, to President Joe Biden. There are three supposedly independent branches of the government committed to checks and balances on each other, not to subservient support of one to the other. Psaki appears to think otherwise, that the Senate is subservient to the executive branch, not independent and equal to it. Manchin is not independently derailing the bill, as he has 50 other Republican votes who recognize that BBB is a skunky bill with a catchy title. Party subservience is certainly in play in the House and Senate, but Manchin is completely innocent of this. He simply wants a much better bill that won't put our country into such a catastrophic deficit we'll never be able to recover from. Our country needs more Joe Manchins and fewer legislators who are in lockstep with the executive branch. From Pat Rapella of Mason City. And our final letter to the editor today is from John Krieg of Des Moines. Climate change doesn't get attention, funding it deserves. Why is it that the U.S. can spend $81 billion per year defending the world's oil supply, but can't muster $55 billion per year to address climate change? The $778 billion in the Pentagon budget, passed recently with bipartisan support, is four times the cost of the Build Back Better proposal. West Virginia isn't the only state with senators whose priorities need to change. Senator Chuck Grassley and Senator Joni Ernst, we need you to step up now, not tomorrow. Again, from John Krieg of Des Moines. And we have a cartoon editorial today from Joel Pett of the Tribune Content Agency. And it appears to be a classroom, and there's a picture of a teacher at the front of the classroom with some things written on the blackboard. And we have a globe and then some kids sitting in the classroom. Standing in the doorway, we have what appears to be a parent with a big sign that says, "No critical thinking about race." And then the assignment on the board is Desmond Tutu, 1931 to 2021. And the bullet points include racism, slavery legacy, colonialism, white supremacy, segregation, and disenfranchisement. And then the teacher says, "Relax, today's lesson just talks about South Africa."
This next article is written by Dave Myers. Dave Myers retired in 2018 after 35 years in law enforcement, including work for the Carlsbad Police Department in California, then for the San Diego County Sheriff's Office. This column is part of a series by the USA Today opinion team examining the issue of qualified immunity. The project is made possible in part by a grant from the Stand Together. Stand Together does not provide editorial input. As a matter of fundamental fairness, people who have been victimized and abused deserve to have their day in civil court. But because of the doctrine of qualified immunity, government workers, including law enforcement, are largely shielded from civil liability. As a 35-year veteran of a major law enforcement agency, I've seen enough cases of police misconduct to know that ending or modifying qualified immunity will increase government accountability, encourage better official conduct, and give victims of police abuse their day in civil court. The doctrine of qualified immunity establishes that unless the victims of government abuse can show that their rights were clearly established, their abusers cannot be sued in civil court and held accountable for their actions. The courts have progressively interpreted the clearly established legal standard in a way that requires victims of police abuse to identify an earlier decision by the Supreme Court or a federal appeals court in the same jurisdiction, holding that the same conduct under the same circumstances is illegal or unconstitutional. If this requirement is not met, the police officer is immune. It doesn't matter whether the officer's actions are unconstitutional, unreasonable, intentional, or malicious. Courts have granted qualified immunity to government workers based on the tiniest of distinctions, and the decisions are all over the place. There's the case of a prison guard shielded from lawsuits because there were no previous cases of an unconstitutional pepper spraying of an inmate, only previous cases involving a stun gun or striking inmates with a baton for no apparent reason. Courts have even granted qualified immunity to police who were accused of stolen large quantities of money because there was no earlier case clearly establishing that stealing by the police is unconstitutional. Because of the extraordinary protection provided under qualified immunity, it is understandable that the police unions and organizations are fiercely resisting the ending or even modifying of qualified immunity for its officers. At the very least, the doctrine should be modified to make clear that a case with identical facts is not necessary to hold officers liable for their misconduct. If we look past the hollow rhetoric of how this doctrine allows law enforcement officers to do their jobs effectively, we will quickly grasp that this doctrine harms victims of police abuse by effectively preventing them from suing their abusers in court. And that is bad for victims, law enforcement, and communities. As Mississippi Federal Court Judge Carlton Reeves wrote in a decision, "Let us not be fooled by legal jargon. Immunity is not exoneration, and the harm in this case to one man sheds light on the harm done to the nation by this manufactured doctrine. Additionally, qualified immunity shields municipalities and law enforcement agencies from taking responsibility for the bad behavior of their employees, which greatly reduces the incentive to change bad policies and practices. Accountability creates a healthy workforce and dramatically reduces liabilities. States like Colorado essentially ended qualified immunity, and we have yet to see the financial ruination of law enforcement officers in those states. Governmental agencies must provide oversight, policy reform, training and verification that our law enforcement personnel are doing their jobs in the best interest of the communities they serve. In doing so, it's an investment in restoring the trust between our law enforcement agencies and our communities." And this column is part of a series by the USA Today opinion team examining the issue of qualified immunity. The project is made possible in part by a grant from the Stand Together. Stand Together does not provide editorial input.
And next, I'm going to pull a piece from the USA Today money section. Act now to save money on taxes before year ends. It's the last week of the year, which means it's your last chance to save big on taxes. By donating to charities or changing your investments, you could save thousands in tax liability. Here are 10 end-of-the-year tax tips, courtesy of TurboTax CPA and tax expert Lisa Green Lewis. 1. Defer bonuses. If your hard work paid off and you expect a year-end bonus, this extra money may bump you up to another tax bracket and increase the amount of taxes you owe, according to Green Lewis. To avoid that, you may want to consider delaying the extra income until the beginning of next year, Green Lewis says. If your boss can pay your bonus in January, you will receive the money around the same time, but it won't be part of your 2021 taxable income. 2. Accelerate deductions and defer income. There are a handful of tax deductions that are recognized in the year in which you pay them, Green Lewis says. For example, if you own a home, you can deduct your mortgage interest. And if you make an extra mortgage payment on December 31st, you may be able to claim the interest in that payment on your 2021 return. Before doing this, be aware that under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act passed in 2018, if you purchased a home after December 15, 2017, you can deduct up to $750,000 in total mortgage interest instead of $1 million for homes purchased before then, according to Tax Act, an American tax preparation software company. 3, donate to charity. If you itemize your deductions, you can help someone in need and reap the benefits of a tax deduction for non-cash and monetary donations given to a qualified charitable organization, according to Green Lewis. Make these donations count on your taxes by donating by December 31st. If you make a donation by credit card, you do not have to pay it off in 2021 to receive the deduction, Green Lewis says. If you volunteer at a qualified charitable organization, don't forget that you can also deduct mileage, 14 cents per every mile driven for charitable services, according to Green Lewis. Under the CARES Act, even people who take the standard deduction can take advantage of a deduction for cash donations of up to $300 made to a 501c3 organization. And that doubles to $600 for married couples filing jointly, Green Lewis says. The CARES Act temporarily eliminated the limit on the number of cash donations you can deduct if you itemize. Usually, deductions for cash donations are limited to 60% of your adjusted gross income, according to Green Lewis. Number four, maximize your retirement. Another great way to reduce your taxable income while building your nest egg is to make a contribution to a 401k or traditional IRA, Green Lewis says. If you are self-employed and contribute to an SEP IRA, you can contribute up to the lesser of 25% of your net self-employment income, or $58,000 for 2021. Number five, spend your FSA. If you have a flexible spending account and have money left, get caught up on your doctor's visits, Green Lewis says. While the old use it or lose it rule does not apply, you may be able to carry over only $550 in your 2021 FSA account at the end of the year. Number six, buy high, sell low. If you have investments that have gone down in value, did you know you can lock in your losses and use them to offset investment winners? To do this, you need to sell the losing investments, according to Green Lewis. If your losses exceed your gains, you can apply $3,000 of that loss against your regular income, and any remainder will be passed to the next tax year, Green Lewis says. Number seven, make adjustments in W-4 withholding. Maybe you did not have the tax outcome you were expecting in 2021 due to changes in tax laws or because you experienced life changes like having a baby, getting a pay increase or decrease, losing a job, or getting a new one. If so, this is a good time to adjust your withholding on your W-4 form and refile it with your employer, according to Green Lewis. Number eight, be aware of the other dependent credit. Do you support your parents or grandparents? How about another loved one? If that happens to be you and they qualify as a non-child dependent, make sure to take advantage of the new other dependent credit. This can reduce the taxes you owe dollar for dollar up to $500, Green Lewis says. Number nine, gather receipts related to property taxes or large purchases. Do you pay property taxes on your home or estate income taxes? Did you pay a lot in sales tax for a large purchase? You can deduct state and local property income or sales taxes up to $10,000. In the past, these taxes were generally fully tax deductible, Green Lewis says. And finally, number 10, take a class. Taking a course to advance your career or improve skills is a great way to lower your taxes, Green Lewis says. Paying for next quarter's tuition by December 31st may give you a tax credit of up to $2,000 per tax return with the lifetime learning credit, Green Lewis says.
Here is an article from the opinion section of USA Today. This is written by Louis Villalobos, and it is called No Federal Solution Puts Onus on the States. Pandemic's End Depends on Where You Live. Well, President Joe Biden finally decided to say the quiet part out loud. After months of carrying on about a national plan and the need to follow guidelines and best practices, he finally threw his hands in the air and admitted it. This pandemic will end when the states sort out how to end it. Look, there is no federal solution, Biden said Monday, according to a transcript of a conversation he had with a group of governors. This gets solved at a state level. Now, if you paid attention to the national trends during the pandemic, you already know this. You already knew that the states and governors hold the actual power in fighting this godforsaken pandemic. You already knew that our experience throughout all of this was dependent on where we live. You already knew this. Just look at how states reacted to the idea of mask mandates and vaccine mandates in schools. Some welcomed all precautions. others weaponized and banned them. I mean the states can't even agree on how to return to normal. But for the President of the United States to casually say the solution to this problem is with the states is jarring, because it makes crystal clear that where we live matters in a way that maybe it hadn't before. Keep in mind that he said this as the nation deals with an Omicron variant that is ransacking the country. He said it as the United States reported more than 500,000 new cases on Monday. He said it as Texas ran out of a vital tool for fighting the virus. He said it as California saw more than 4,000 COVID hospitalizations on Sunday. And that's a drop in the bucket of what states are dealing with. My family moved out of Arizona for work months before the pandemic hit. So we've ridden out the pandemic in Virginia, but watched as the state we spent so much time in is run by a governor who joined the fight against mandates. It's not surprising that Arizona has one of the highest COVID-19 death rates in 2021 and sits in the middle of the pack in the percentage of people vaccinated. This isn't me criticizing a Republican governor or saying blue states have handled the pandemic better than red states. That's the type of blanket nonsense statement that has contributed to the poisonous discourse about the pandemic. What I'm saying is that it's become frighteningly clear that Americans will walk away from this pandemic eventually, having lived different versions of it, and that Biden outright saying there is no federal solutions means we will be on our own for the rest of this evil ride. Because he can offer all the support and prayers and good vibes in the world. The Centers of Disease Control can change its guidelines at will, and Dr. Anthony Fauci can evangelize vaccine mandates until the network television shows get tired of asking him. None of it will matter if you live in a state that will ignore it all. If you live in a state where your elected officials think mask mandates and vaccine mandates are fascist, your situation will not change. If you live in a state where you wish the governor would issue mandates and do more to protect students, that will not change. Mostly, it means that help isn't coming for those of us who want it, and that mandates aren't coming for those who hate them. It also means that the lack of a federal solution clears the way for continuance of state-specific band-aids, which will likely extend the pandemic while we sit around and argue over how to fix this. And Louis Villebois is a member of the editorial board and an editor at USA Today Opinion. Follow him on Twitter at Louis Villebois.
And another piece from the USA Today Opinion section is written by Barbara Streisand and Dr. C. Noel Berry-Mers. Give women tools to combat heart disease. The last thing we need during the holidays, especially amid a global pandemic, is another reason to worry. But women in particular should be concerned about their heart health. A decade ago, we joined forces to combat gender inequity in cardiovascular research, research, treatment, and prevention. We knew heart disease was seen as a men's disease, despite being the number one killer of women in the United States. That women were excluded from research studies, and that even many doctors didn't know that women's and men's hearts and symptoms are not the same. But we never imagined a pandemic would impede our progress. That's what is happening today. Researchers are predicting a tsunami of heart disease and other chronic conditions, a confluence of the COVID-19 crisis, during which deaths from heart disease accelerated, and holiday heart syndrome, the spike in alcohol, and stress-related cardiac disease. Yet among the repercussions the pandemic will have on the long-term health of American women, we've heard little about its impact on our hearts, a reflection of inequity and a pattern of neglect that we've been fighting in our health systems and beyond for generations. A disproportionate impact. What we need now is a concentrated, bolstered effort to address the gender and racial inequities in the quality of heart care. And we need much more research on women and heart disease. What makes it different? How best to prevent and treat it? Cardiovascular disease kills about 10 times more women a year than breast cancer. For example, in 2018, more than 420,000 women died of cardiovascular disease, whereas 42,465 died of breast cancer the same year. Yet, few women know the basics of how to protect themselves. We know that the coronavirus directly impacts the cardiovascular systems of the infected, something we're learning more about every day. This cresting wave of cardiovascular illness likely will fall disproportionately on women, especially women of color and low-income women who are more at risk for cardiovascular disease. Making matters worse is the fact that compared with men, heart disease among women remains under-recognized, understudied, and underrated, and women are underrepresented in clinical trials. This must change. Broken heart syndrome. We've long known that stress is a key culprit of heart disease, and a study published in October and co-authored by Dr. Barry Mers builds on this and should serve as a fair warning. It found that from 2006 to 2017, women older than 50 were diagnosed with Takotsubo syndrome, or broken heart syndrome, a heart attack-like event resulting from stress, up to 9 times more than men of any age group. Future research most likely will show a substantial spike because of COVID-19, continuing a troubling trend. The number of women who die of heart disease has risen every year over the past decade, particularly among younger women of color. This is in part because women are less likely than men to get the treatment they need when hospitalized and more likely to do poorly after a heart attack. Yet only 1 in 5 American women understands that heart disease is the leading cause of death. Fewer than half of primary care physicians and cardiologists feel well prepared to assess cardiovascular disease in women. That this is all happening in 2021 is unconscionable. And then knowing the risks. To be sure, we need the research and investments to bring about systemic changes. However, we also have enough to put a simple solution in place now. Tell women they're at risk and tell them how we save their hearts. That starts with educating women about the symptoms of a heart attack, which include jaw pain, shortness of breath, backache, extreme fatigue, nausea, and dizziness. Far from the stereotypical image of a man clutching his chest in pain. We also can encourage women to talk about heart disease with friends and family. Organizations like Women Heart offer peer-to-peer support, which is key to both a healthy recovery and fighting the stigma that still surrounds heart disease. We need a national wake-up call, federally supported campaigns, sustained over a period of years and properly funded, have proven to be highly effective at raising awareness of smoking, diabetes, and other diseases, and ultimately at improving heart outcomes in the United States. A similar public health education campaign about heart disease could raise awareness among the most vulnerable women nationwide, educate doctors and the public about gender differences in symptoms and treatment, and would benefit the more than 43 million women in the United States living with or at risk for heart disease. What are we waiting for? COVID-19 is likely to be endemic, sticking around like the seasonal flu and creating one more dangerous variable for women's heart health. Let us hope that this pandemic ends the historic neglect of this critical issue for women. There is no more time and no more excuses. Barbara Streisand is founder of the Barbara Streisand Women's Heart Center at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles and co-founder with Ronald O. Perlman of the Women's Heart Alliance. Dr. C. Noel Barry Mers is director of the Barbara Streisand Women Heart Center, the Linda Joy Pollan Women's Heart Health Program, and the Erica J. Glazer Women's Heart Research Initiative at the Cedars-Sinai Heart Institute, where she is a professor of medicine.